Intrafalsal, both the anterior, posterior, and the dorsal ventral axes are established during oogenesis. In this slide here, you see an egg chamber in mid-oogenesis, and at this time, both the anterior, posterior, and dorsal ventral axes are well established. This egg chamber consists of three cell types. There are the germline-derived nerve cells at the anterior end, and the oocyte itself at the posterior end of the egg chamber, and then the germline derivatives are surrounded by the follicle cells, which are a mesodermally derived tissue. The primary anterior-posterior axis is established very early in oogenesis when the oocyte moves to its posterior position within this cluster. The dorsal-ventral axis is established when the oocyte nucleus moves to one corner of the developing oocyte, and whichever corner it moves to will become the dorsal side of both the egg and the embryo. Those primary asymmetries that are established within the oocyte are signaled by the oocyte to the overlying follicle cell epithelium and induce the follicle cells to respond to these asymmetries. And then at later stages, the follicle cells signal back to the oocyte and elaborate and further modify these initial asymmetries. The oocyte signals these asymmetries to the follicle cells with the help of the gene product encoded by the Gherkin gene. In this slide here, you can see the Gherkin RNAs labeled. Early in oogenesis, you find the Gherkin RNA and the Gherkin gene product all over the small oocyte, and the Gherkin signal then signals to these overlying follicle cells and induces them to be posterior. These posterior follicle cells then signal back to the oocyte and induce a change in the cytoskeleton of the oocyte, which results in the specification of an anterior-posterior polarity within the oocytes that is important in sorting out maternal messages to the anterior and posterior pole of the egg. This change in the cytoskeleton, however, is also important for the establishment of the dorsal-ventral asymmetry because it induces the oocyte nucleus to move from its initial symmetric position in the oocyte to one corner of the oocyte. And since the Gherkin RNA, by an unknown mechanism, remains closely associated with the cytoplasm around this oocyte nucleus, this Gherkin RNA, the Gherkin protein, then at this later stage acts as a dorsalizing signal and induces the follicle cells, which are now here on the more lateral side of the egg chamber, to become dorsal. The receptor for both the posterior and the dorsalizing signal is encoded by a gene that we call Torpedo. It encodes the Drosophila homolog of the EGF receptor, and it was originally cloned in my lab by Jim Price, who's here in the audience and who has continued to work on this receptor and its downstream and its functions. The signal that's used in oogenesis is encoded, as I said, by the Gherkin gene. There are multiple ligands for the Drosophila EGF receptor in the genome of the fly, and these ligands, such as, for instance, the Spitz gene product, signal to the receptor in other tissues at multiple times in development. Gherkin, on the other hand, seems to be relatively oogenesis specific and encodes, as I said, this germline signal that signals to the overlying follicle cells. Here again you see, it encodes the signaling molecule that belongs to the TGF-alpha family of proteins and is made as a precursor that's inserted in the membrane, and here you see how tightly localized the protein, the signaling protein, is during oogenesis, so that probably only a limited number of follicle cells at any one time see a high concentration of these signaling molecules and are induced to become dorsal. Work from a number of laboratories has shown that the signaling pathway between the oocyte and the follicle cell involves quite a number of genes. There is a large, there seems to be a high regulation of this signal during oogenesis. On the germline side, the Gherkin RNA is made, and there is a number of genes that are involved in localizing this RNA to this cytoplasmic domain around the oocyte nucleus. Then there are some genes, the biochemical functions of which are unknown, which somehow are involved in activating the signaling process. For instance, the gene cornichon, which was worked on in my lab by Siegfried Roth, is absolutely necessary for active signaling to occur. However, the Gherkin RNA and the Gherkin protein are found in cornichon mutants, so we imagine that cornichon somehow activates signaling. Maybe it's involved in processing the ligand or activating it or maybe secreting it. Cornichon encodes a small protein. It's no homology in the functional homology in the database. There is yet another level, however, of regulation of the production of this signal in the germline. And in my lab, we became aware of this when a graduate student, Nancy Hawkins, started to work on mutations in a gene that she called ENCORE. She initially started to work on this gene because it causes a phenotype in oogenesis whereby the germline undergoes an extra round of mitosis, giving rise to egg chambers that have one oocyte but 31 instead of only 15 nurse cells. So ENCORE seems to have a role in the regulation of germline mitosis. And Nancy showed that this regulation goes via a gene called BAM that is involved in promoting germline mitosis. However, when Nancy analyzed alleles at the ENCORE locus that were not very penetrant for this germline mitosis defect, and in particular at low temperatures where the germline defect is practically not existing, she realized that these mutations were cold sensitive for a ventralizing effect. So here, over here, is a wild-type egg chamber. This, what you're looking at is actually the egg shell, which is produced by the follicle cells during oogenesis. And so by looking at the egg shell, we can deduct follicle cell fate. If we go along, we're looking at this egg chamber from the dorsal side, and if you're interested in follicle cell, dorsal ventral follicle cell fate, we would identify along the midline something that one might call dorsal midline follicle cell fate. These follicle cells more anterior give rise to a structure called operculum. More lateral, there are follicle cells that will produce these dorsal appendages. So this there is a sort of dorsal lateral follicle cell fate that is manifested by looking at, by seeing these dorsal appendages. And then the ventral follicle cells are relatively undistinct. Now, in the weak mutants here, what happens is that we lose the dorsal appendage operculum follicle cell fate first, and which results then in a fusion of the dorsal appendages. And then in more strong examples, we lose even more follicle cell fate, follicle cells that would make these dorsal appendages, coming to a moderately ventralized or strongly ventralized eggshell phenotype. The embryos that develop inside these eggs are also ventralized. Now, seeing that ENCORE has this effect, Nancy and then later a new graduate student in the lab, Cheryl von Buskirk, looked at Gherkin expression in ENCORE mutant egg chambers. Over here is the RNA, the Gherkin RNA. In wild type, you see it's tightly localized to the region around the oocyte nucleus, and this is more or less the case in the ENCORE mutant egg chamber. So the effect doesn't seem to be primarily on the Gherkin RNA. But then when they used an antibody to Gherkin, they found that in these egg chambers, especially at 18 degrees, there was almost no Gherkin protein made. And whereas at 25 degrees, where the phenotype is much weaker, a little bit of Gherkin protein becomes visible again. They confirmed this on Western blots and found again that at 18 degrees, there's a strong reduction of Gherkin protein in these ENCORE mutant egg chambers. we would therefore put ENCORE, they cloned Encore and found that it is one of those genes that you have heard about in the meeting. It's one of these large genes with no homologies to anything in the database, and doesn't quite know where to start taking this apart. And so we don't at the moment know what the biochemical function of Encore is. We would like to place it here into a group with some other genes that have been shown in our and also in other labs to be involved in the regulation of translation of the Gherkin RNA. This comes particularly from the work of Paul MacDonald, who has looked at a gene, has shown that the gene Aubergine is involved in the regulation of translation of both the Oscar RNA and Gherkin RNA during oogenesis. The gene ORP has been shown by several groups to be involved in translation. We've also found that ORP affects Gherkin translation, so we think that Encore might also be involved in this. There's also the possibility that the Bruno gene is involved in regulation of Gherkin translation because there are some Bruno response elements in the Gherkin 3' UTR. However, we don't at the moment know whether they have any functional significance. What it seems, therefore, and what we're trying to do now, using as molecular probes for these other genes become available, we are trying to find out whether Encore indeed interacts with these other gene products and whether Encore as and whether the Gherkin RNA, in fact, associates with a complex, with translational control complex, as it has been postulated to be the case for Oscar. And if you have heard the talk by Anna Frusi, then you could use this as a paradigm, the Oscar RNA as a paradigm for what may be happening to Gherkin during oogenesis. So it seems that the signaling process is highly regulated and that there are several levels of control to make sure that there is just the right amount of Gherkin produced during oogenesis. Now let's look at the downstream response. There is work from several laboratories, notably Norbert Perrimon and Celeste Berg, has shown that the RAS-RAS signaling cascades act downstream of this receptor in the developing follicle cells. If we look at the response of the follicle cells, we can define two readouts of this response. For one, the follicle cells on the dorsal side assume the dorsal follicle cell phase. For instance, they secrete dorsal appendages or operculums. But there is also a repression by this pathway of a second signal that is later on sent back by the follicle cells to the embryo and that influences or regulates the embryonic dorsoventral pattern. In order to understand a little bit more about these response pathways, a graduate student in the lab, Anne-Marie Queenan, constructed an activated form of the torpedo receptor, EGF receptor. And she did that using a suggestion made to us by Dennis Montel, who had used this idea to create an activated form of the breathless FGF receptor in flies. And what Anne-Marie did is fuse the lambda, the dimerization domain of the lambda repressor into the extracellular domain of the torpedo kinase. And this forces dimerization of the kinase and starts the signaling going. Now, if we express this construct in flies, it's lethal. And so Anne-Marie had to put it under UAS control and use the system pioneered by Brandt and Perrimon to be able to have this toxic construct in one line of fly, and then we can cross it to another line of fly that expresses the Gal4 transcription factor under a tissue-specific enhancer. We isolated also some Gal4 lines that are relatively specifically expressed in follicle cells. So we have one line that expresses very highly in all follicle cells, another line that also expresses in all follicle cells, but to a lower level and a little bit more irregular, patchy. And then we have two lines. This line here was given to us by Norbert Perrimon, which only expresses in anterior follicle cells. Then we have one line which predominantly expresses in posterior follicle cells. So then Anne-Marie crossed this activated torpedo construct to these Gal4 lines. She saw that she would obtain different phenotypes depending on what line she was crossing this activated construct to. In a weak expressing line, we see just what you would call a weak dorsalization of the egg chamber. If we take a line that expresses in all follicle cells, but at an intermediate level, then you can see that we get now a ring of dorsal appendage material formed all around the egg chamber. If you take the very strongly expressing line, you get a different phenotype. Here, it appears that all follicle cells here have turned into this dorsal midline operculum cell fate, which now surrounds this egg chamber. So this, we think, is the most dorsalized eggshell that we can obtain. This series shows that by just expressing different amounts of an activated receptor, we can induce different follicle cell fates. High concentration of activated receptor induces this dorsal midline operculum fate, and intermediate activation, we get dorsal appendage fate. And if you think of a null mutation in either, well, the receptor or the signaling, which would give us a ventralized follicle cell fate, you can define at least three different cell fates that are specified by different levels of the signal. Another thing that I would like you to notice is that when we look at these dorsal follicle cell fates that are produced, they're all confined to the anterior end of the egg chamber. So we don't see dorsal appendage material or operculum produced here in the posterior part of the egg chamber. And in order to understand this a little bit more closely, we used some molecular markers that respond to Gherkin torpedo signaling during oogenesis. The first marker is the KEK1 gene that was cloned by Norbert Perlmutter, and Norbert showed that it responds to Gherkin EGF receptor signaling, and in the wild type, it comes on normally in a patch around stage 10, in a patch overlying the region where we know there is high concentration of the Gherkin protein. If we go in and look in our line that expresses Gal4 and the activated receptor in all follicle cells, you can see that now KEK1 is expressed in all follicle cells. So the KEK1 promoter seems then to be a promoter that can respond in all follicle cells to activation of the pathway, regardless of of which follicle cells within the epithelium this concerns. In contrast, this is actually a behavior shared by several other response genes, but I'll only outline one, is the rhomboid gene. Rhomboid was initially cloned by Ethan Beer, and then its role in oogenesis was studied by Hanoi Rohola Baker. And Hanoi showed that rhomboid is also expressed in response to the EGF receptor signaling in dorsal follicle cells overlying the nucleus where we have Gherkin protein. It shows a little bit more of a dynamic pattern in that it initially comes on in a patch which then resolves into two lateral stripes. If you look at rhomboid expression again in our activated construct, so again, even though we express the activated receptor here in all follicle cells, rhomboid only comes on in a band along the anterior margin of the oocyte. This indicates that rhomboid and, as I said, several other response genes, such as Argos, for instance, have promoters that, even though they can be activated by the EGF receptor, they also seem to require input from an anterior-posterior patterning system that must exist in the follicle cells, such that only these anterior follicle cells are competent to respond. We don't know at the moment what such an anterior-posterior patterning system in follicle cells might be. It's possible that DPP, which is only expressed in anterior follicle cells, plays a role, but we don't at the moment know this for sure. It is, though, then a question, in fact, about these posterior follicle cells. Do they, in the wild type, actually really respond to Gherkin torpedo signaling directly? Or is maybe the real wild-type response only performed by these follicle cells in this anterior patch, which see high levels of Gherkin protein for an extended period of time? The more posterior follicle cells do see the Gherkin signal, but only transiently during development, because the way the oocyte grows, it will initially more posterior follicle cells will be opposed to the region of the oocyte where Gorkin signal is produced. But as the oocyte grows away further anterior, the question is, do these follicle cells remember that they have seen Gorkin, and do they remember that they should be dorsal? Or is it that only these follicle cells here really respond to EGF receptor signaling, and that they then somehow produce a secondary signal that instructs the rest of the follicle cell epithelium? In order to look at this question, Anne-Marie used these lines that express SCALF4 only regionally within the follicle cell epithelium, and I only want to show you one such example. So here are eggs and embryos produced by the GAL4 line with the activated receptor, where the GAL4 line only expresses the activated receptor in the posterior part of the follicle cell epithelium. The eggshell here looks normal. That is, since we don't really have any markers that would allow us to distinguish dorsal conventional follicle cells in this region, we can't really tell whether anything has changed in these follicle cells or not. But if we go and use the embryo as another and maybe a more fine readout of what's happening in the follicle cells, then we can see that no, what's happening with these follicle cells is that the embryonic dorsoventral pattern is correctly established at the anterior end of the embryo, where we get the normal head and thorax, but at the posterior end of the embryo, this embryo is dorsalized, showing that these follicle cells in fact did respond and gave the wrong signal to the underlying oocyte and embryo. Conversely, I can just tell you that if we express the activated receptor only in the anterior end, you get an embryo that is dorsalized at its anterior that has a normal posterior end. This tells us then that the follicle cells can at least regionally autonomously respond to the EGF receptor signaling, and in particular we can, for instance, obliterate the signal, the normal signal in the anterior end, and yet the posterior follicle cells can still respond, they still make a normal pattern, indicating that they have received dorsoventral pattern information independently of what the anterior follicle cells are thinking. Okay, so when we therefore look at the two readouts of the signaling process, we would say that there are, if we look at dorsal follicle cell fates as measured, say, by follicle cells making appendages or operculum, we would say this response requires EGF receptor signaling, but it must also get some input from some anterior posterior signal. Whereas if you look at the embryo, that's the embryonic response, then it seems that the EGF receptor activity alone is capable of giving dorsoventral pattern information all along the axis of the egg. Now, finally, last part of my talk, I'd like to ask the question a little bit more, what precisely happens here in this embryonic response? What do the follicle cells do to send this signal back, and how does EGF receptor signaling influence this, whatever pattern information is produced in the follicle cells and sent back to the embryo? We can look at this in a different view, sort of in a cross-section through the egg. So what I've told you so far is that we have EGF receptor signaling on the dorsal side of the egg, which dorsalizes the follicle cells, but it serves to repress a new ventral pattern formation process that takes place later, actually, in fact, after the egg is laid, and involves a protein cascade that activates the transmembrane receptor TOL, which then gives the information on to the dorsal cactus complex that's present in the egg. Now, there are three genes known, noodle, pipe, and Wnt vital, that are required in the follicle cells to somehow activate this protease cascade. And in some fashion, the signaling of the EGF receptor serves to repress possibly the activity of these genes somehow during oogenesis in the follicle cells so that they're only active on the ventral side. But what exactly, what pattern do they make? What is that ventral pattern forming process, or what shape does it have in the follicle cells? In order to understand this better, a postdoc in the lab, Laura Nielsen, made homozygous clones in the follicle cells that were mutant for Wnt spindle noodle and pipe. She used a FLIP-FRT system to induce such homozygous clones in follicle cells. She also used as a marker the DEC gene, or defective chorion gene, that has been cloned the mutant that you want to study. The phenotype of these defective chorion clones is such that we can actually see it on the egg. So it produces, if you put the eggs under sort of water or glycerol, it produces a transparent appearing chorion or eggshell. So out here where you see the little hexagons, we have the normal wild-type eggshell, and then here we have a clone of transparent cells, which are now also homozygous for Wnt. If we look at the embryo that's formed inside such an egg, we find that if we have a clone, it's on the ventral side of the follicle cell epithelium that overlaps the ventral midline in the anterior part here of the egg, then the embryo underneath will be dorsalized in this region of the egg, but will have a normal dorsal ventral pattern in the wild-type part of the egg. Here I'll show you a ventral clone that is more posterior, and now we have a loss of ventral cell face, or a dorsalization of the posterior part of the embryo, whereas the anterior is normal. And then finally, if we, however, make a clone on the dorsal side of the eggshell, and it can be rather large, we still get a normal embryo formed inside this egg. Looking at these clones, then, to say the same results is also true for doing clones with pipe. Laura could say that both Wnt-Spindle and pipe are required on the ventral side of the egg in order to impart ventral pattern information to the embryo. In order to be more precise, to assay this process more precisely, Laura then turned to use a molecular marker for dorsal ventral pattern formation. She used here an antibody to the TWIST gene, which is normally expressed in ventral cells of the embryo, the ventralmost cells of the embryo, and serves as a marker for the regions of the egg that have the highest concentration of activated dorsal protein. Now, what Laura has to do here is she has to wait until a female lays an egg, then she photographs this egg, determines where the clone is, then she waits until this egg reaches the cell or blastoderm stage, takes the single egg, fixes it, stains it for twist, and then matches the embryo back to the photograph of the clone. And so she was able to show that there's actually a very good match between where the Wnt-Spindle clones, homozygous clones, are and where the twist expression is disrupted. So here you have this clone here, it stops here, and here is the twist expression stops very abruptly. Here's another clone, and again we lose twist expression in this region of the embryo. By mapping out, looking at many of these clones and mapping out exactly what was happening, Laura was able to show that Wnt-Spindle and pipe activity are required in a stripe of about six to eight follicle cells wide on the ventral midline. If the clone was wide enough to completely span this region, this ventral region, then this resulted in a complete absence of twist expression. If the clone is very thin, as you can see here, it doesn't have much of an effect on the twist pattern. So now, with these results, lastly, I wanted to say how noodle, on the other hand, acts differently. Here, we can make large ventral clones, and the embryo still develops normally. It appears that as long as there is still a substantial amount of wild-type cells present in the egg, the embryo will be able to make a normal dorsal ventral pattern. So noodle is not necessarily locally required in the follicle cells to act to help make the ventral pattern process. So now we can think about Laura's results in two ways. It seems that somehow through the action of the EGF receptor pathway, and it may not be a very direct action, of course, somehow a ventral preparens, the stripe that I was talking of about 6 cells wide, is defined in the follicle cell epithelium, and that the activity that's produced in this stripe depends on the activity of the genes pipe and windpipe. So it's possible that all we get in the follicle cell epithelium is this stripe, and that, however, in the embryos, we need to make a gradient of the activated dorsal protein, so that somehow downstream of the activity present in the follicle cells, there may be some type of diffusion. I've here indicated diffusion possibly of the Schwestler ligand in the intracellular, in the peritoneal fluid, but it could also, of course, be diffusion. We could have a model where we have diffusion, as has been suggested by Mike Levine in his talk, diffusion of the activated toll receptor in the plasma membrane that would bring about the actual dorsal gradient. Alternatively, it could also be that what's happening in the follicle cell epithelium is that the gradient, there is already a gradient of pattern information established in the follicle cell epithelium. So again, we have this 6-8 cell stripe, wide stripe that's important for twist formation, which, as I said, indicates the highest level of the dorsal protein. But there could maybe be also a little bit of pattern information graded in the follicle cells that would be responsible for these lower values of the dorsal gradient. In order to distinguish these possibilities, Laura has started to look at response genes like short gastrulation that are indicators of these intermediate and lower values of the dorsal gradient. One prediction, for instance, that you could have if this gradient model was true, if we eliminated just only this medial domain, the 6-8 cell wide domain, we should still find short gastrulation expressed. Whereas if it's a diffusion model, then if we eliminate pattern information in the 6-8 cell stripe, wide stripe, then we should not see short gastrulation expressed anymore. Now, it's a little hard to find clones that are exactly 6-8 cells wide, but Laura has looked at some other clones, and they actually give us the answer. So here's a clone that is in the posterior part of this egg chamber, and it eliminates, we know from previous experiments, it would eliminate twist expression at around this level here. Now, this white area, therefore, we would expect would actually express twist. And then in the wild-type part of follicle cell epithelium, we see short gastrulation expressed as expected, flanking twist. But at the boundary, where we've made the boundary, now short gastrulation starts being expressed in sort of U-shapes around this boundary. And this tells us that clearly there must be some diffusion, because we've made a straight boundary here stopping the ventral, the twist domain, and now we have all of a sudden the short gastrulation expressed in a domain that it should normally never be expressed, and it forms sort of this gradient, as if it would have been, as if some activity had now diffused out of this boundary domain and activated or made the slope of the dorsal gradient. Therefore, finally, we would say that right now, even though not all the details, we still have to work out some of the details, and the model is maybe a little bit too black and white the way I'm drawing it. But the major effect of the AGF receptor signaling is to outline a stripe here on the ventral side of the follicle cell epithelium that's only 6-8 cells wide, and that contains the ventral pattern information. And then the dorsal gradient is formed by some downstream mechanism that actually then makes the graded values. Just lastly, I would like to say that, of course, we're very interested in what now pipe and windpipe encode, since they seem to be so closely linked to the establishment of this ventral domain. Mary Consolati in my lab has cloned windpipe, and unfortunately, it encodes again a protein with no homology or no significant homology in the database, so we don't quite know what it's doing. Also, windpipe RNA is expressed in all follicle cells, although the mosaics say that you require the activity only in these follicle cells. So we would now think that windpipe is maybe not the direct target of this EGF receptor. Repression target might be pipe or a factor X, and that factor X might then require maybe wind voids for processing or activation in some way that we still have to figure out. So lastly, let me acknowledge all the people in the lab who've done the work. I've talked about Anne-Marie Queenan, who worked on the activated torpedo EGF receptor, Cheryl von Buskirk on Encore, and Nancy Hawkins' work on Encore. Amin Gabriel also helped with the analysis of the activated torpedo EGF receptor. And finally, Laura Nielsen did follicle cell clones and Mary Kosolansky cloned wind spikes. So thank you for your attention.